Welcome to Seeking Alpha, the podcast where we're diving deep into crypto, careers, and the chaos of modern dating. I'm Larissa Bunzia.
And I'm Lindsay Poss. Together, we're two women who somehow found themselves at the intersection of crypto Twitter, Silicon Valley, and Tinder.
All right. Welcome back, bitches and ladies. Lindsay, how are you?
Man, it's been quite a day. Also, I want to point out we're recording this before Labor Day. So I'm taking my last opportunity to wear white and enjoy summer.
There are no rules. You can always wear white after Labor Day. It is chic in the winter.
That's true. I do love a winter white. And you and I look like we're in completely different seasons.
Big news from me. I think I have a favorite animal.
Which is?
Guess what it is. Guess.
Well, you're wearing a cheetah print, so I'm going to go with that.
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, as an adult, I've always said cheetah or lion was my favorite animal because I identify with those. But it turns out I think my favorite animal is a bear. I am obsessed with bear videos now. Have you seen any?
No, this is funny, though, because my father has a deep, deep phobia of bears. Like, that man is not afraid of anything in this world, like former military, whatever. Terrified of bears.
So okay, I have some stuff to send him.
Deep fear of bears. I think they're so cute, though. And I'm a huge Chicago Bears fan. So, like, I'm pro bear.
Why do you have to bring sports into everything?
That's who I am. Anyways, tell me about your bear content.
So, I was watching this video of a bear that went to a house and it was like a Ring camera and it pawed it. It was ringing the doorbell and then nobody answered. So it went around the house and got into the jacuzzi. And then there was another video of this bear that broke into an ice cream shop and it scooped all the flavors into its mouth and tasted them all and decided its favorite was strawberry. So it sat there and ate the entire carton of strawberry ice cream. It's so funny, but just never look up bear without fur because that's terrifying.
I don't need to know. Yeah, I don't need to know.
Also, there was this nightmare story of a woman whose face got ripped off by a bear and she had full facial reconstruction surgery. And she said that the most pain and problems were caused by insurance after, not the bear.
That's so real. I have grown up with bear lore much more in the camp of that Reddit lady. Then the kind where it's like they're eating ice cream. My funniest thing about bears is that I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, my brother was talking about how dangerous and scary they were. It was so funny to me because he's like, Lens, like they're like the ultimate predator. You can't climb a tree. You can't swim. You can't run. Blah, blah, blah. And I just kept thinking like, it's like hearing my dad.
Just give them some strawberry ice cream apparently and a jacuzzi. They love that shit.
All right. Enough bears. Teach me about tokenized securities.
We only like bears in real life, not in markets. In markets, true, be like bulls. Speaking of something that we are bullish on, tokenized securities. Are they the future of finance or are they just finance in drag? Recently, when we were in Cannes, Vlad, the CEO of Robinhood, announced that Robinhood would be issuing tokenized stocks of OpenAI and SpaceX. Made it sound like they were going to be offering equity in the companies. And then OpenAI went to Twitter and was like, the fuck you are. And they put out this disclaimer, like, this is not actual equity. Like, this is a warning, protect yourself. And so tokenized stocks are something that has been heating up lately. A lot of platforms are not offering them or planning to offer them. Coinbase is planning to offer them. Kraken began offering them in Europe. And I wanted to talk about this trend and what it means. So traditional securities is a tradable financial asset. It's stock, a bond, mutual fund, or ETF. And basically, you buy a piece of something. So you buy a piece of Apple, the company, and you go through your broker, you own it in your account, and you can only trade it during market hours.
These also, fun fact, used to be physical papers. So people would actually hold real paper copies of the stocks and trade those on the trading floor a long, long time ago. Crazy.
That is not fun at all, but crazy.
I think it's kind of fun because it shows how far we've come.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. Okay, you're right. You're right. It is fun. It is fun that these used to be paper. But so tokenizing these means that you're taking an asset like a stock, bond, fund, and you're issuing a digital version of it on the blockchain. Basically, tokenization is like when music went from CDs to Spotify. So suddenly songs were accessible online 24/7 globally and easier to move around. So instead of going to your broker, you just buy a blockchain token from an exchange that represents Apple stock, and it becomes tradable 24/7. And the greatest part is that anybody in the world can have access to it. So it means that US markets, which are the most in demand in the world, become open to investors in Kenya, for example. Beyond that, you can fractionalize ownership. So if an asset is hundreds of dollars, you can own just a piece of it. So you can own a piece of an expensive stock or whatever other asset.
One of the ways that I understand this is with tokenizing, it's that global part that's really different than buying fractional shares of another stock. When it's tokenized, I believe that that's the thing that actually makes it cross-border. Whereas, yeah, for example, like I as a US citizen can go in right now and buy stocks of these things in Robinhood, but someone's living somewhere else wouldn't necessarily have access to that app. So it's really right. Kind of the global border problem that tokenization solves, as far as I understand, or like the main one.
Yeah. That's okay. The biggest component of it, that and the 24/7 trading aspect, gotcha. Because the prices move with the assets. So there's no slippage and there's high liquidity. So
can we, just because a lot of people might not be familiar, can we go through slippage and liquidity really quick? Slippage refers to the price that was expected of a trade and the price at which it's actually executed. So slippage occurs, like if I place a buy order, even if it takes 0.25 seconds to close, that price could actually fluctuate within that 0.25 seconds. So you want to minimize the amount of slippage that you get when you are trading. So obviously, that closing time is super important, which is also a benefit of tokenization, is that obviously trading on the blockchain is a lot faster, it's more instantaneous, but that like time to finality is a lot shorter, so it can prevent slippage. And then liquidity is a measure of how many buyers and sellers there are in the market. So the more buyers and sellers there are, the more likely it is that you're going to be able to execute a fair market price, as in like you're going to reach that equilibrium of what the thing is worth and what you're paying for it a lot faster if there's a lot of people buying and selling it. So high liquidity dampens volatility. It smooths out those price fluctuations. Below liquidity increases the volatility, because then you have buyers and sellers basically being able to stretch each other more on that price.
Yeah, exactly. And traditional settlement times are like 2 days, even for digital stocks, which is insane. So if you're dealing with very volatile assets, which crypto is, stocks less so, but still can be, it makes a big difference to have that instant settlement time on the blockchain. So this is a big controversy in crypto. There are two ways to tokenize securities. The first one is to tokenize them natively and to have these native tokens, where the security itself is issued directly on a blockchain by the actual asset manager or issuer. So an example of this is Franklin Templeton's tokenized money market fund, which we've discussed before. Native tokenized stocks don't really exist yet because of compliance and regulatory issues. But this is the better alternative that everybody is vying for. It's more transparent, less counterparty risk, but just doesn't really exist yet. We haven't gotten there. Wrap tokens is like the IOU version. So this is what Robinhood is doing. And it's taking an existing stock or bond and issuing a blockchain-based IOU that represents it. You don't really hold the asset, so you're not actually holding equity in the company. You're holding the issuer's promise that they'll back it. And so you can be quick to market with this. As we've seen, Robinhood has been, Kraken was, Coinbase is going to be, and it lets people trade stuff that isn't natively tokenized yet, which nothing stocks-wise really is. Obviously, it's centralized, there's counterparty risk, and it's very misleading because people think that they're buying equity in a company when they're actually just buying an IOU of equity in a company. And so, relatable terms, wrapped assets are the guy who's showing you a screenshot of his bank account balance when you're on a date, and a native asset is the guy who's taking you shopping and actually paying for all your shit. Obviously, what we want is the native token guy. What Robinhood did is especially fucking crazy because they tokenized shares of two private companies. So Vlad got on stage and was like, yeah, we're tokenizing equity in OpenAI and SpaceX. Meanwhile, both of those are private companies. So how are they doing this? They bought secondary market shares of private companies. They bought through a specialized brokers from early employees or investors that sold their shares. Then they wrapped them. Then they issued IOU style tokens that represent them. So their marketing.
That's nuts. I didn't think about that, because obviously you and I were together when this announcement was made. And honestly, at the time, I was thinking more about the blockchain that they chose to tokenize on than I was about the assets that they actually tokenized. But I want to say that again, because this is a private company. So it's owned by a set of shareholders, usually the employees. And they went and bought those shares from a broker on a secondary market. So now Robinhood itself owns those shares, but they're saying we are going to hold these shares and then we're going to issue a token based on these shares that fluctuates based on the price of these shares. But since it's not a publicly traded company, how is there even price data?
They're in some fucking custodian's account, in some fuck all bullshit with the prices going crazy. The price, there was like a 200%.
The price would just be based on valuations, right?
Yeah, but the valuations change. Right. And there was like a 200% discrepancy at one point between the actual price and what the tokens were selling for.
Dude, that's nuts. That's nutty.
Yeah.
These are the publicly traded, like, you know, I'm familiar with things like synthetic stocks. So synthetic stocks are when you're able to buy a stock without actually buying the stock. That's a whole other thing. But the point is, like, all of that uses publicly available price data. So like with a public company, you know what the price is trading at. If you're tokenizing shares of a private company and then issuing IOUs based on those, like, you are just shooting in the dark with what you're going to, like, you can make up anything. Like Robinhood can be like, oh, these are worth this now. And no one's going to be like, oh, that's wrong based on my super insider knowledge because I own a token of a thing that's not even real that they bought on a secondary market.
That's it's fucking crazy. And so that's why OpenAI made this disclaimer that was like, you're not actually buying equity in our company. We do not recognize this as equity and we don't allow transfers of equity in this way. And it's this big debate now. I mean, the whole private versus public company is a whole other thing, but the debate is really over whether wrapped tokens are okay when native tokens are expected to be coming once there's regulatory clarity, if that ever comes. But that's seen as like the right way to do it. And I was talking with somebody who's at a company that is trying to do this the compliant way. And he was like, I actually just think it's really rude that these companies are offering tokenized stocks of companies that didn't opt into this. He was like, it's just rude. They didn't ask them for permission to offer shares of their companies. I'm like, yeah, that is one way to make business judgments is whether something is rude or not. But I mean, it's true.
It's not a hot take because it is true, but it's a funny take because it's like, clutching his proverbial pearls at this. Like, they did what? My stars.
Yeah. So it's interesting. There's definitely a lot of optimism. I'm optimistic about tokenized stocks. I'm optimistic about what it means for investors globally, democratizing access. I mean, the US markets are like $64 trillion. And the fact that so many people are kept out of this, like, and could be included by tokenizing assets on blockchain, like, it makes all the sense in the world. But companies are rushing to do it, and it raises many more questions
to do that with a private company on top of that,
because then being private,
I somewhat understand doing tokenized assets based on price available. I actually know of a company that's doing this. They're doing synthetic assets that way, so you know that you're not buying, for example, a Tesla stock, but you're buying an asset that mirrors the price fluctuations of a Tesla stock, and it's called a synthetic. Like, it's fully synthetic. It is literally just a tool to do sophisticated gambling and sophisticated trade gambling. But the thing is, if you are outside of the US and you believe in something like Tesla or Google or whatever, then buying a synthetic token that's actually backed by high liquidity is still a decent option because it's essentially just a mirror of the market. So long as the liquidity is high, which means that there is a high volume of people actually buying and selling that synthetic stock, then I don't really have an issue with something like that being used or being created, like a synthetic, but just fully tokenizing a private company stock and then allowing people to bet on that when there is no publicly available price data, you don't have support of the project, there's not high liquidity in that market, is so bonkers to me. And there's no like traceability of it. So you're saying that you are tokenizing the stocks that you own in that company, supposedly. But like, where are those? I'd rather have something that's fully synthetic at that point. Like, just give me a token that represents OpenAI's valuation and let me bet on that. Like, that would truly make me happier, which is like more of a Polymarket Kalshi thing. But truly, like, that would make me happier. Like, hey, buy a token that is that is OpenAI at this valuation, and at the next valuation, you can cash in or cash out, or like you can bet whether it goes higher or lower.
Yeah.
Like that would make more sense to me in this scenario. This is just total and utter BS. Like if you're going to fake something, like fully fake it or do the real thing, like don't half ass it.
Yeah.
Synthetic or real, nothing in between.
It's funny also because Elon Musk didn't respond to Robinhood's tokenization of SpaceX, but he responded to Sam Altman's criticism of the OpenAI tokens.
Finding.
And said, like, your equity is fake
to That's Sam incredible. Altman. I mean, he may be right. It's a private company. I don't know how it operates. The Robinhood thing is so much worse to me too. Oh my God. It's giving LeFoufou. I hate it.
LeFoufou?
Yeah.
Are there LeFoufou? Okay. I think I almost bought you a LeFoufou. But yeah. I didn't. Yeah. I couldn't tell if it was real or not. So I didn't buy it.
There are signs. There are signs. It's got to have 9 teeth. I've done a lot of digging into real LeFoufou.
Not signs to the untrained eye. I'm not standing there counting fucking balls to LeBoubou connoisseur. Oh my God. What's her latest beauty fix that she's gotten?
Oh, I was part of a transformational LeBoubou BBL. A LeBoubou the other night. I'm being so honest. We gasified it. It was great.
But gasified.
Yeah. I told you.
I think you know your podcast co-host.
Yeah. Been taking a lot of inspiration from there. Okay. So the key thing is that all the institutions see how much money this saves them and how much global liquidity this unlocks, right? Because like we talked about with liquidity, the more buyers and sellers there are in a market, the better for the volatility of the market, the better market efficiency, the fair pricing, whatever. But also that means the more money to be made. You know, the more people buying and selling your shit, the more money that can be made. And so realistically, if bigger institutions are finding that they can stop going through massive licensing regimes and all this stuff just to get more buyers into their markets, I think like sooner rather than later, they're going to push for the regulatory clarity that they need in order to make that happen. So it makes perfect sense to me.
Of course. And like institutions have already gotten into the tokenization game. I mean, the amount of tokenized US treasuries is vast now, like BlockRock's Biddle, Franklin Templeton's Benji Fund. So like it only makes sense for stocks and ETFs to be the next iteration. It's just taking longer because there are more regulatory hurdles there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, now I finally kind of understand slippage and liquidity. And honestly, those both sound like porn terms now that I'm saying that. Trading stocks is dirty.
It is. It really is. It was probably like some fucking bros back in like 1800s laughing at each other, making up these terms.
There's no way bros in the 1800s knew what liquidity was. They didn't even know how to give an orgasm. No chance.
So you still do.
Yeah. Anyways, speaking of modern times, I wanted to talk about something I've been thinking a lot about lately. And, you know, I celebrated my birthday last week and my family was in town. We're sitting at a table with my aunt, my uncle, my dad, who are all roughly of the same era. So born in 1950s now, around 60 years old-ish, 60 to 70. My sister had asked the two women at the table, like, oh, what sports did you play in high school? And my aunt was like, we didn't have sports for girls in high school. And I was like, wait. Like, this was just like one generation ago that there wasn't sports. And then I started thinking about just the sheer amount of opportunities that I've had in comparison to literally one generation ago. And there's this line in the Barbie movie that said, mothers always stand still so their daughters can look back and see how far they've come, which I think is so beautiful and really powerful. But I was thinking about that a lot because one of the things that I deeply struggle with is knowing that I have all of this opportunity available. Like my aunt couldn't even play sports in high school. And I was just down in Guatemala last month playing basketball in like local leagues. Like that's how different the world is. That I was like in another country where I don't even speak the language, playing a sport at a pretty high competitive level. Like that's so utterly different than her world was when she was my age. And she's the one who looked at my mom one time or after they graduated high school. And she said, what else is there to do besides get married? And like now we can do anything. Like when she graduated high school, she couldn't even open a credit card. We can do anything. And so what I'm struggling with is knowing that I'm someone who wants a family. I want children. I want a good relationship. I want to accomplish all those things and have, quote unquote, the more traditional life in a lot of ways, but also struggling with like, okay, but I almost feel like I like not owe it, but like, I feel like I should do all of these things, like take advantage of all these opportunities while I still can before the family thing comes in, because I'm the first generation that's been able to. And so it's this weird thing where I'm like, wow, I truly can do anything. And that is fucking amazing. And I would not trade that. And I fucking love that. But it's also like, huh, but that's really limiting my ultimate goal of like having a family in a way right now. And like, I'm trying to figure out how to balance those two things. But the more I do and the more I become and the more that I get into, the more I'm like, fuck, like I'm hungry. I'm hungry to do more and be so ambitious. And I'm like, but then like, when do kids in a relationship fit into that? And like that balance is really hard for me. And I wanted to talk to you about it specifically because I know you've talked about in the past, like you've never regretted putting time and effort into yourself and your own accomplishments. And so I wonder how you think about that balance, like of all this opportunity, but then also like wanting other things out of life as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely really tough because time is finite, right? Like you could die tomorrow and you don't want to not have accomplished things that you had wanted to accomplish. I think it was Warren Buffett. He said, make a list of your top 25 things that you want in life and order them from what you want the most that you cannot die without having to the thing that you want the least out of the things that you want. And circle the top five, cross out everything else. And everything else, don't just wait for those, avoid them at all costs because the top five things are what you want to center your life around. And the other 20 things are seductive and interesting enough of ambitions to distract you from the top five things that you actually want. So I think it comes down to really being serious and honest with yourself about what you want from life. And if you were to die in a year from now, 6 months from now, what would you have wanted to accomplish? And prioritize those, like reverse engineer how you want the end of your life to look and prioritize that way. Because like you don't have time. Like it feels like you have time for everything, but you really don't. And like, there's no reason to assume that you'll have time for it later because like, it's like that financial saying, you'll love this. It's like that financial saying, pay yourself first. Like with your time, you have to like pay your priorities first because if you end up just squeezing them towards the end, you'll always maximize like other things, like other stuff will take up that time that you have. And it's limited. It's a limited resource. So you want to put what is most important first. And if that is having a kid and a family, like it's something you can try and intertwine into like what you're doing. Like you travel a lot. So like, I don't know, maybe trying to meet somebody as you travel, which actually don't do because I travel with you and well, we could go guy hunting, but not husband hunting. That's like a totally different game.
I totally agree with all of that. And actually the Warren Buffett thing is a thing that I've read too. And especially the part about the seduction of all the other things. I think what I'm struggling with, and I did talk about this a little bit on Twitter earlier, is just that with love and with family, it's harder to like type A your way through it. Like, of course you have to go on dates. You have to do all of these things, whatever, but it's, I speaking from experience of going through a divorce and now a very difficult breakup, if I could just turn around and find the person that I wanted to build that with, life would be so much easier. And I know that there's like a structure and a method and a strategy and I can be on the apps and I can meet people and I can do all of this. But to your point about like, oh, maybe you'll meet someone while you're traveling. The best kind of connections and things form when it's like a little bit more spontaneous or natural when it comes to like love and family. And I'm definitely struggling with putting myself in those situations or being available for those situations, particularly after just a lot of heartache and staring down the barrel of like, okay, but then there's all these things that I want to do, you know? So like, yeah, my top priority has always been family. Like that's always been number one. That's what I wanted for a really long time. That's why I wound up getting married young to a person where it just didn't quite work out. Like I was dreaming of that. And so it's always been that. But I feel like the more pressure I put on that, the worse it gets. And in the meantime, I'm like, okay, well, what if I do all of these other cool things? But then like the longer I start doing all of those other cool things, the further out of reach that like love and family feels like as like I develop and grow and change and all that stuff. So it's just, it's strange.
Yeah, I know. It's like, it's really hard and weird because like the factors are out of your control when it comes to relationships, which like sucks. Like I hate it. But I think like, as we know, like it's a numbers game, dating. are largely a numbers game for most of us. And like wins are quick and unexpected. So like in certain domains, mm-hmm. like consistency is key, where like if you just keep showing up and keep doing the same thing, like at the gym, like you will get the results ultimately. But in social domains, like they're quick, unexpected, and spontaneous. And you need to just create enough surface area for opportunities to meet people come to you as much as you're showing up to meet them. So like going to like singles events or whatever it is, just prioritizing ways to like find somebody could be a way of working on that without actually having to like go through the mental anguish of going on a million first dates, because you're setting yourself up to be in a situation where like you could meet somebody. It's hard, like the trade-off is hard, but as long as you're still finding doing what you want fulfilling, then you can't look back and be like,
it's just coming to terms with all of the opportunity costs that I'm struggling with.
Yeah. Flip it on its head and just think of it as like all the stuff that you get to do still. And then ultimately, this is the factor that sucks, is that like you just have to trust that it'll work out somehow and like you will find somebody when the time is right.
I'm just struggling with balancing all of that, of like also having gone through a lot of heartache lately too, and knowing if the right person walked around the corner tomorrow, would I even be ready? And that feels really lame to say and really sucky, because I'm like, I wish I could just get over everything that has already happened to me and just let it go. But I'm struggling with that, and I'm struggling with how to move forward, and I'm struggling with not moving forward fast enough, because I'm like, what if the right person does pop up and I'm not ready? Or what if I'm not searching out the right person in an effective enough way and I should be, but instead I'm like focused on my career goals, all this stuff. So I think like it's just a lot to think about, and I don't feel the time pressure yet, but I think to your point of like, you know, feeling like things are finite, I'm always kind of thinking like, okay, but where do I want to be in a year? And so that's the part where it's like, I usually have a pretty good idea of what that looks like. I'm very good at making my own dreams come true. And so like, if this is a dream that I have, like, what am I doing today to work on that? And I think not being able to take that type A approach and having to take a more of a like wait and see, or like trust that it works out approach, is, yeah, it's like really fucking hard. I'm used to being super pragmatic, super executional, figuring out how to actually make things come alive and come and work. And I can't do that here. And I just spent another 2 years on a person where like I desperately wanted it to work and it really didn't. Like that sucks. And I'm like, shit, I don't want to make that mistake again. I don't want to mess up again. But then that closes me off to even trying. And so it's like a whole weird conversation with myself where I'm like, okay, you need to relax. You need to let it happen. And when it happens, you can't force it. Like it's like a whole cycle of like telling myself these things that I know are true logically, but emotionally I'm like, but what am I doing to make sure that I have the family that I want? Like it's a fucking struggle, dude. It's a struggle.
It sucks. I mean, one thing that helps me, and this totally contradicts what I said earlier about operating as though you're going to die tomorrow, but there are examples, even in the crypto industry, of women I know who went through similar things, like really were career oriented in their 20s and 30s, and by their early mid 30s were feeling really desperate, honestly, because I was sitting next to somebody and she was like, I will literally let the next guy who comes up to me impregnate me. And I was like, okay, that is desperate. But she wound up marrying she's the most beautiful girl. Like he's the most attractive guy and like 37. And that's just when it worked out for them, was at 37. And that's fine. That's still young. And they wouldn't want to be with anybody else. So any of the guys that she could have met in her younger years, like she wouldn't have wanted to end up with. And stories like that are really hope inspiring for me.
Definitely. Also, I saw a stat the other day that said there's more mothers in their 40s than teen moms in the U.S. for the first time. And I thought that was actually pretty cool. Like, I think everyone's figuring it out. It is a different world than our parents did. You can't just like work at a regular job and buy a regular house and have kids. The financial part of it has changed. The life orientation has changed. AI is here and everything's about to change again. I think our generation does need a little bit more time to like figure it out and commit. I'm scared. I'm scared of the opportunity cost. I'm scared of the process. I'm scared of trusting that much. It's hard.
Yeah. I mean, this is maybe wild take. We're still so early to be talking about lifelong commitments. Like in the 1600s, the average marital age of a woman was 21.
Wow.
21 in the 1600s. And they were expected to die in their 30s. Right. So like putting that proportionally, that would be like the norm being people getting married in their 70s or 80s now. Huh. Cool. So like we are not late. Like everybody else is just like super, super fucking early. Like weirdly early. Like marriage evolved into this societal expectation of people when they're in their 20s and 30s, and just structurally, the logic isn't there.
Yeah. Yeah, not anymore. God, not anymore.
Yeah.
All I'm saying, Laura says, someone needs to give me some chubby babies at some point before I die.
Okay.
It's always been family for me. Number one, never has changed. I have not been afraid of an accidental pregnancy since I was like age 14, since like way before I even started having sex. Like, I've been like, no, if it happens, like everyone's going to be over the moon. Like everyone's going to be so excited. Doesn't even matter. My family loves, like we love babies. We love kids. It's always what I've wanted. I knew that was going to stun you into silence.
That's one way to get me to shut up.
Yeah. It's true though. So anyways, should we do the segment that we forgot to do last episode?
Yeah, things we like. Mm-hmm. So what do you like this week?
Okay, this week, because we've been talking so much about Drag Race, a thing that I really liked is I went to a Dolly Parton themed drag brunch recently.
Fun.
It was so fun. It was while you were in Ibiza and I was like, fuck, this bitch is in Ibiza. I gotta do something fun and cool. And so I went to Dolly Parton drag brunch.
That's cooler than Ibiza.
It was so cute and so fun. And the thing that I liked the most is that I got compliments from all the queens, which was so cute. Highly recommend the drag brunch weekends at Stella 34. It's in the back of a Macy's home furnishing shop. Fucking hilarious. Go to Stella 34. It's so fun.
Well, what I loved this week and every week since you introduced me to it is the chirp wheel, which stretches my back. And now I cannot travel without it. I take it everywhere. I use it every day, multiple times a day. And I cannot say enough good things. You never know how badly your back needs to be stretched until you use a chirp wheel.
The chirp wheel is life-changing. Enough. Medium size. That's what we all want. Medium size. Don't get fooled by the cheap $17 one. You want the $35 one.
I mean, I bought the whole set. I have all of them. Ooh. I have all the sizes. And I use them back to back. And it is fucking amazing. Life-changing. Chirp wheel.
Have you used all three at once?
No.
You should try that. I just want to know.
I don't even know how. It wouldn't like fit on my body.
Lower back, middle back, upper back, and then you just roll on all three. I want to see if it's possible. We can test that.
We'll experiment this weekend with it.
Yeah. Well, we did it. Everyone knows the drill. 5-star ratings and reviews. Send the pod.
Send it to a friend. Send it to your enemy.
Text me that you listened. God, I love getting messages like that. Fucking love getting messages. Leave us notes, comments, questions on the website or on Twitter DMs. Send your hate mail to Larissa.
Yeah. And since we said it last time, we'll say it again. Live episode coming October 22nd in New York. Details to come. Love you guys.
I'm so excited for that, by the way. It's going to be so fun. But yeah, everyone who's in New York, come to PupKey on the 22nd or we're not friends anymore.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.